Hello and welcome to Pitchside with Toby Reynolds, a Sports Gazette podcast, where each episode we take a deep dive into a new sporting topic with a new guest. I'm your host Toby, and this week I'll be joined by Andy Nolan to discuss the commercial side of international rugby and the future growth of the game. Andy runs the TikTok page Rugby Nors, where he discusses rugby news, talking points and match recaps to his 40,000 followers. Throughout this episode, we look at the exciting start to this year's Six Nations, how the Netflix documentary might help grow the game, and the likely introduction of paywalls into international rugby within the UK and Ireland, as well as what first led him into TikTok. I'm now joined by Andy. How are you, mate?
I'm doing well, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, going to basically talking a little bit about the future of rugby. And I mean, the best place to start right now is the Six Nations. We're 2 weeks into what has been a really, really good start to the competition. It's probably been the closest ever early phase. I mean, Italy have looked decent, which has been is obviously been an upward trend of recent. What have you made of the first 2 weeks?
I think it's an interesting one. I don't think anybody expected the result in Marseille on the opening night. And I think that's kind of like, that's really thrown a lot of the predictions out the window. On my side, I thought France were going to win it. I thought they might win a slam just because of the fixtures they had, but they're missing Dupont so badly. And they just seem, it's so strange because their club sides are going so well. I can't quite work it out. I would have thought that even without Dupont, they'd be able to put up better performances than that. But for whatever reason, they're struggling. Ireland looking fantastic, Nick. They just look, they're right at the top of their bounce. And, you know, with the players they've added, they might even go higher. And then you've got Scotland, who I think after the World Cup, if I was in like a decision-making role in Scottish rugby, I'd be sort of scratching my head about where we go next, because it's the best group they've ever had. It's another disastrous World Cup where, I mean, they did also get shafted by the draw, right? So it's not just their fault, but that's happened 2 World Cups in a row now. And you have to start asking yourself, well, how do we move on from here? What comes next? And then Wales and England, I mean, Wales is a full-scale rebuild. Doesn't seem like there's a huge amount of pressure internally. Nobody really expected much, and the players are kind of making the most of it. And then with England, it's bizarre because it's kind of a rebuild. There's a lot of new players, but tactically, like, they just, I thought they showed a little bit against Italy that made me think, oh, maybe they really are serious about changing the way they play. And then in the Wales game, you know, as soon as they get under pressure, they go back to what they know. And you just think, is this, when you look at the way the other top teams play, are they ever going to get to the level of, say, South Africa or New Zealand or Ireland playing the way they do? And I'm not sure. But I think the tournament itself, like the games have been really, obviously, except the Italy games, have been really intense and really close. Yeah, I think it's been a brilliant start. And I'm really, really excited to see, like, Scotland, England's going to be massive next weekend. That's a real chance for both of those teams to kind of, for Scotland to lay down a marker and say, like, the France day was a bad day, for England to say, we really are coming on and we're really improving. And yeah, France have a chance to get their mojo back against the Italians. And then it's going to be really interesting to see how Ireland cope with, like, how attritional and hardworking Wales are, because I think that's a real challenge. But I don't think Wales have enough when they actually get the ball to really do any damage, but we'll see.
Yeah, it will hopefully be another exciting few weeks to round off the tournament. I think Italy are quite an interesting one. They've obviously finished, well, last, had the wooden spoon for almost all of the tournament since they joined in 2000. I think 22 wooden spoons, I think they've won, which is absolutely mental.
It's crazy.
They definitely look the best right now that they've ever looked. I mean, they beat Wales 2 years ago, and they're probably in quite a good position to beat them again this year. What do you make of the sort of side and how much they've improved in the last sort of 4 or 5 years?
I mean, it's great to see. I do think, like, I'm going to be a bit of a party pooper here. I think there's a lot of people equate the fact that they throw the ball around more with having gotten a lot better. And I don't know if that's true. Like, they throw the ball around more. They're definitely more exciting to watch. Italy games used to be an absolute dirge to watch because they just try and spoil and make it as hard as they possibly could. And in all honesty, I think you probably have a better chance winning matches that way. But I know players don't want to do that. And so at least now they're trying to inject some life into Italian rugby. They play a much better brand. They have great moments. They're really exciting to watch at times, but they're so loose. And the concentration and fitness seems to be a much bigger issue for them than it is for everybody else. And you know, it used to be that they never had the ball. They have quite a lot of the ball now. So they don't even have that excuse. I think a lot of it is like, the psychological damage. I went to a school where we played rugby and we never won. And so I know that feeling of getting ready to play and already you're beaten, you know? Like, you know the other team are better than you and you're going to lose. And I know it's professional level. I know they're elite sportsmen, but losing almost every game for 20 years has to have that sort of an impact on you mentally as well. And I just think, I don't know whether it's that they need to have like a complete clear out, start picking all young players and try and build that culture up again. Because I don't know how you teach a bunch of lads who've lost every game for how long have they been in the Six Nations? 30 years or something.
Since 2000s was when
Oh, yeah, 20
Six
years.
Nations.
Yeah. And I don't know how you teach them to go beyond themselves and to have that self-belief when it's never really happened before. And you know, when they beat Wales a couple of years ago, it was amazing. I was in the airport with my missus. We were watching on our phone. It was incredible. Like, I felt like I was there. It was that intense. But I don't think we'll see that this year. I just think Wales are too tough. And they're not trying anything. They're not trying anything overly complicated. And I think that is probably enough to get you over the line against the Italians at the moment.
Yeah, you'd assume so. I mean, I think the point about picking the young kids could be an interesting one because they won the or they've done really well with an under 19 side over the last few years, and you've seen a lot of them come in and start playing for the full side now. So yeah, maybe if they can rotate out and filter in nicely, that could be quite a good way. But then I guess also you do need some guys who have played international and are international caliber. So it's finding that balance, isn't it?
It's difficult. It is difficult. And like, I mean, I wouldn't want that job, you know? Like, I think Quesada he has a serious job on because the Crowley era for Italy started so brightly. Everyone got really excited. And then the World Cup was just a disaster. You know, it wasn't just that they got hammered by New Zealand and France. It was like, particularly against the All Blacks, they broke mentally. Like, you could see the point in the game where they all just kind of switched off and they were like, I just want to go home. I just don't want to be playing in this game anymore. And so you've got to come in, you've got to pick up the pieces from that. You've got to try and keep the good things, which, like, obviously, they have some great players. Like, the Menichello at 12 looks like a really, really good player. And they've got some good players in the forwards as well. I can't remember the seven, starts with a Z, but his name's escaping me at the moment. But yeah, they've got good young players. And like you say, in the 20s, they've got some really good players. Like, they really pushed Ireland a couple of weeks ago in the under 20s. I think they only lost by a couple of points in the end. They could have gone for a drop goal and they didn't. So it was an Ireland, you know. Ireland had shaken it up a bit. It wasn't their full first team, but to think of like an Italian under 20 side going to, I think Ireland have the best production line in Europe. So at age group level, probably the best team in Europe, and going there and almost coming away with something for Italy, that's huge. So they just need to get more of those guys into professional club rugby. They just need, I think they need someone though to like catch fire and go and play for a big French team, you know, kind of like what happened with Capuzzo. But I think they need someone who's maybe a bit more, who can exert more influence on a game, right? Caputo's a finisher. He has great moments, but he's not going to control the game. He's not going to take you through it from start to finish. So I think maybe they need a 10, maybe a 9 that they can kind of play off. And yeah, although, I mean, I'm saying that and I'm describing Garvisi. Like, they have that and it hasn't been enough. So I don't know. I wouldn't want to be on the Italian Rugby Federation board because I don't know how you solve it because everyone else is getting better too every year. So you've got to get better, what, five or six times faster than everyone else? It's impossible.
No, it's a big challenge. I mean, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about Georgia coming into to the Six Nations, maybe replacing Italy or being promotional relegation. Do you think that that might be a good idea to try and really push Italy to try and not finish bottom every year because they will just fall out and lose huge amounts of money if they don't play in the Six Nations?
Yeah, I think for that to actually happen in the Six Nations is a non-starter because I think all six federations have like a veto vote for changes, and the Italians are obviously never going to go for that. And I know the VCs who bought into the Six Nations, they're very interested in protecting the IP, and letting more teams in is going to dilute that. That's not going to happen. But with the new World League and the new setup there, being World Rugby, you know, it's going to take them 10 years to make it work. But the plan is eventually to have those two divisions. So you could have a team like Georgia who've got to be on the edge. You could have a team like Georgia coming up and down, playing some of the big teams sometimes, you know, starting to get a bit more like accustomed to playing those big sides, and then hopefully getting more games against the lower tier sides. But every time they announce a change, it's clear what they want to do is mostly protect the interests of the big nations, who already have quite a lot of skin in the game. And on the one hand, you feel terrible for the tier two nations. And then on the other hand, like, there's a business reality to this, right? Even the big nations, it's like this rugby. Like, if a few things go wrong, if we have another COVID year or whatever, some of those unions could go out of business. So I understand why they're so protectionist about it, but it just feels like everyone at the highest levels of rugby is just waiting for Saudi money or American money or whatever money they can court to come in, and then they can start making some bigger gambles. But until that, I just think they're going to play it completely safe.
I mean, the Netflix documentary is obviously one step they've tried to take to bring in some more money and try and grow the game where possible. I mean, it's obviously worked massively well in Formula One. They've got golf and tennis have the same documentaries, the All or Nothing stuff on Amazon Prime. Similarly, first of all, what did you make of the Netflix documentary? Did you enjoy it? Did you think it was revolutionary, like a lot of people thought it could be?
I didn't know what to make of it. You know, I watched it before the Six Nations started, and it like got me right in the mood. There were bits I liked and bits I didn't. I love that they focused on the player personalities. I think that came at the expense of, like, one of the things I loved about Drive to Survive. I watched that. I wasn't a Formula One fan beforehand. They spent 10 minutes at the beginning just really beating the idea into you that there are 20 seats in Formula One, and that's it. And so it doesn't matter if you're the worst guy on the grid, you still have one of the top 20 seats. And so it made everything matter in the documentary after that. And what I was disappointed in the Six Nations one, there was no framing at all. They didn't explain how the game worked. They didn't even explain how point scoring worked. They dived right into it. They kind of ignored the complexity of rugby and the rules in general. And they just focused on the people, which was amazing. I didn't know Sebastian Negri had that backstory. And it was fantastic to listen to that. And also, I didn't know he nearly died in that game against England. Like, it was amazing to learn that stuff and to see the kind of little bond between him and Genge that happened after that. And all that stuff was brilliant. But, you know, a lot of rugby pundits talk about, you players could do that without Netflix. Like, if the unions were a bit more relaxed about what players shared and how players were on social media, stuff like that, we could see those moments. We don't need a Netflix documentary crew to come in. So when I finished watching it, I was just left wondering, like, who is this for? Like, it didn't feel like it was for new fans. It certainly wasn't for people like me who followed the Six Nations religiously, because I remembered everything that happened. They didn't really go into much depth. But as like as a showreel for the players and what personality could do in rugby, I thought it was brilliant. So a bit of a mixed bag, yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I thought that, well, I found, I same as you, I got into F1 through Drive to Survive and found that really interesting. But as I know more about Drive to Survive, I found each series has been less interesting to me. And I feel like, yeah, similar with rugby, I knew what happened last year. I watched all the games. whereas the player-wise, I found it really interesting. Yeah, finding all the new guys out. You know, you found a lot more about Ellis Genge, who I kind of knew of and obviously seen him play for England for a lot, but yeah, you kind of find these different stories, and he'd obviously almost didn't ever play rugby, which would have been crazy to think that he
yeah.
was probably a few choices away from not playing for his country. Do you think that maybe they might learn, if they do it again next year, that they need to maybe either aim it more at sort of new entrants and new fans, or even go really deep into it and try and draw out some interesting stuff for people who have watched a lot more of rugby?
Yeah, I wonder, because I always think as well, what seems, when you see the end product, you think everything's a creative decision. But like, we all know they had tons of trouble behind the scenes. Like, some of the teams didn't want them in any intimate moments. Like, I think they managed to upset Ireland and Wales management team, and they weren't allowed in the dressing rooms and stuff like that. So you don't know how much of it was just a lack of cooperation. So they kind of had to do their best to build the story around it. I would hope, but again, like what I said from before was, they should have just focused on Italy for the first season. The first season should have just been the story of Italy losing every game, but how much effort and passion and heart goes in. Let's get to know a bunch of the players. Let's really embed with them, because they've got the most to gain, right? They've got nothing to lose from doing a documentary. Just like they did in Drive to Survive, they only worked with the lower-end teams to begin with. And then I think the higher-end teams would have seen the value of it and maybe would have been more open to it. But I think, yeah, what we got for whatever reason was ultimately just a bit surface level, and with the exception of the players who kind of opened up, there wasn't really loads in there. But you know, if season two we get access to more players and more people tell their story, overall that's probably a positive. So yeah, sort of remains to be seen.
No, definitely. I mean, I think you're right there in saying that actually, if they focused on Italy, because Italy seemed to give them almost everything they wanted, whereas Warren Gatland and the Irish team were definitely a lot more closed off, and you kind of saw what you probably could have seen on social media, like a few training montages, a few things here and there. And actually, same as Mercedes, Red Bull, and Ferrari in Drive to Survive, you didn't really see them in the first series or second series. Then you got a race with them, and now you're basically following just those big teams because that's where all the money is, that's where the interest is. And yeah, I mean, if they'd focused on Italy a lot more and almost made it an Italian documentary, that could have maybe been a way to move it forward, I guess.
I think so. I just can't imagine people wouldn't. I don't think you need to have watched the sport to fall in love with a bunch of guys who give absolutely everything to never win. Like, I think that level of dedication, and it works really nicely as a metaphor for rugby because, you don't like people who make it as professional rugby stars, you don't get like footballer money. You don't get I never have to work again money. You completely destroy your body over the course of a career, all for other people's entertainment. And at the end of it, you're kind of just left with the stories and the memories, but you're not a superstar, and so on a like a small level, that's what those Italian guys do every single year. Like they throw it all on the line, they don't win a game, but they don't stop working. And I think that's about as inspirational as it can get. And I think that would have worked really well, but sure, what do I know? I don't work for Netflix, so.
Maybe they'll change it up next year, and they might do something completely different, and it might be better because of it. And I mean, I guess that's the hope for any rugby fan. On a slightly different note, there's been a lot of talk about paywalls coming into rugby. I mean, at the moment, ITV and BBC show everything in England and the UK, and it's completely free to watch the whole Six Nations, all of the World Cup, and internationals and stuff as well. Whereas the Rugby World Cup, there was a lot of talk about everything going behind a paywall for that. The Six Nations now have kind of announced it. What do you make of the fact that maybe in 5 years' time it might be impossible to watch any rugby without paying for it all?
Yeah, I think that's possible, a probability. Like, I think that's very likely. What I actually learned during the World Cup, I made a couple of videos about paywalls and stuff. What I learned is that we are in the UK and Ireland insanely lucky because we get it on free to air. Nobody else gets it on free to air. The Africans have to pay for it. New Zealand's have to pay for it. Australians have to pay for it. So we are kind of the last holdout of free to air rugby. And, the trade-off is. The trade-off's pretty simple, right? If you let the big money in, you go behind a paywall, you get more money to market, you get more money for the clubs, the financial health of the game is better. It doesn't really seem to have impacted attendances in the Premiership. Like if the Rugby Premiership, the attendances are pretty strong this year, after a little dip after the World Cup. But the fan experience is worse. You have to pay to see it. So it means that less people are going to seek it out. You're going to get less numbers tuning in, but the numbers you get are way more valuable to the sport. And rugby has faced the economic reality of being a professional sport a couple of times over the last few years. And so for me, like it's a simple decision. They have to, because if they keep trying to keep, if they keep, if they leave everything on free to air, if they keep trying to make it accessible to people, that's really noble. But if you don't make enough money from it, you can't continue as a sport. Like it's an existential thing. So yeah, it's a shame. And I think the idea that like by having it on free to air you get more kids interested, you get more kids involved, I think that's been proven incorrect because I think mostly because of the concussion stuff and all the stuff about how unsafe rugby is. Grassroots kids rugby, I understand, is like flatlining and there's way less kids playing. They're finding it really, really difficult to keep clubs open, and it's been free to air this whole time in international rugby and it hasn't changed that. So I think if you look at the examples that are sort of that are worth looking at, like cricket, I think is a good one, right? They used to have everything on free to air. They went behind Sky Sports. Way less people watch cricket, but cricket's killing it. Like there's more money in it. It's a much bigger juggernaut commercially. It makes much more sense. So I think rugby probably needs to look at doing something like that. And it's not great for fans, but I really think it's as simple as like, do you want the sport to continue? And if you do, then it's going to start costing us some money.
The one thing I do hope that when it happens is that all of the rugby goes onto one channel. The thing that infuriates me, particularly with football and a little bit with cricket, but cricket actually does it well, where Sky basically own all of the England rights.
Yeah.
With football, it infuriates me when you have to have six different packages to watch one weekend of football. They'll be showing some on Sky, some on Prime, some on BT. The BBC might get some EFL stuff, ITV might get some, and you're having to pay sort of hundreds of pounds just to watch a few games of football, which doesn't really seem the right way. And if the Six Nations is on BT and the Premiership's on BT and maybe the World Cup's on BT, although I think they will likely keep a lot of the World Cup on free to air because same with football, a lot of the cricket, particularly the finals as well, have to be on free to air, I think, is what
Yeah.
I'm saying. And so yeah, as long as I think there's one subscription you pay and you get everything with it, I think that might be the best option.
I think the ideal scenario for rugby, because Amazon are clearly dipping their toe, right? They've done the Autumn Nations, like they've clearly been thinking about it. I think the ideal scenario is that it ends up on Prime because it's not an expensive subscription. Like I think the biggest disaster is if it goes to TNT or whatever, because the cost of that is just mad. Like it doesn't make sense. Although I suppose if it's something like the Six Nations, you'd probably pay for the tournament. Maybe it wouldn't be as bad. You wouldn't have to have it year round. But yeah, I think Prime, get the Six Nations on there. The level of coverage they've done before, I thought was quite good. And yeah, if it has to be behind a paywall, let it be an affordable one. And I think Amazon do a pretty good job. So I reckon that's probably where the people running the Six Nations, that's probably where their head's at.
I think the one thing you do gain as well from having it on a pay behind a paywall is I think the coverage itself would be a lot better. I mean, I've noticed it in cricket. Some of the analysis you get is unbelievably good. Whereas particularly the World Cup, I found a lot of the coverage from some of the pundits wasn't particularly insightful.
Yeah. Do you know who I feel for? Poor old Flatman, David Flatman, just holding it up for everybody. Like his analysis is brilliant, and then some of the guys they get in alongside him, it's wild.
Definitely. I mean, that's I guess the one hope is that maybe if they can move it over, they might have a bit more to invest in it. They'll be able to possibly train people up as well, because even with the cricket, I've noticed that some of the guys about 10 years ago were fine. They were okay commentators, but just because they've done it full time effectively now, because that's all they do, they've naturally got a lot better at it. And whereas a lot of these pundits are just dipping in for a Six Nations, just dipping in for an Autumn Internationals, just for a
Yeah.
cup. And are having to try and do completely different things the rest of the year, effectively, and you're not going to get anywhere near as good. Whereas Michael Atherton, who is arguably one of the best commentators in all sports, is just there following England cricket, following Test cricket, and going and commentating on absolutely everything, and therefore has honed his skills into being a very good commentator.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see the argument, right? Like, I'd love Amazon assembling a dream team. Whoever you like on comms, there's a lot of good commentators. But on analysis, just get Austin Healey and Flatman in the same room, and I'll just listen to it all day.
The World Cup was very, very poor for the Northern Hemisphere. England were the only team to make it through to the semi-final, and even that was a little bit touch and go with the quarter Fiji. Obviously, you kind of have to look back at Ireland and France playing effectively a semi-final in the quarters in what were definitely the two biggest games of the tournament, other than maybe the final.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's maybe something the Northern Hemisphere could be looking at? Because it seemingly happens every year now, or very often, that the Northern Hemisphere sides never seem to quite peak.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the view that this time it was different. Like, France lost by point or whatever. Ireland lost by, what, 2 points? I can't remember the margin. I've tried to block that evening out of my head completely. I was there. It was horrible. But it wasn't a case of, like, being outclassed. Like, in the France-South Africa game, South Africa, one of their USPs is because of the 6-2, because of the nature of the forwards that they have on the bench. Like they can go bigger for longer in games. That's how they win matches. That's their game plan. France's game plan usually involves like first 20 minutes, we're going to absolutely blitz them. We're just going to try and get so far ahead that we can just manage the scoreboard from there. And that nearly worked. But the South African game plan was just that little bit better, and they pipped them, right? For Ireland, New Zealand, I think New Zealand, they capitalized on a couple of things that other teams weren't doing. There was a lot of talk after we smashed Scotland in the groups. Why didn't they kick it in behind? Why did they just run it? Play after play. Why not kind of take that Ireland rush defence out of the equation, get them turned and make them panic? And that's exactly what happened in the New Zealand game. Beauden Barrett was amazing. He's just putting these little short kicks in behind, and it got Ireland totally bamboozled. And then New Zealand were able to run some really nice first phase moves, and yeah, it all went pear shaped from there. But Ireland still went toe to toe, and but for Geordie Barrett's knee getting under the ball, we'd have been in the semi final. So other years, I definitely think there's been this thing where the Northern Hemisphere just seem to have this edge. Like they seem to handle knockout rugby better. They seem to be cooler in the moment. But I still feel like this World Cup was a little bit of a turning point because they ran them so close. And both of those games really could have gone either way. A couple of refereeing decisions, a couple of big moments. And you know, it was a shame that it was in the quarters because then the semis were didn't feel as, I mean, the England South Africa game was great. I loved that. But the New Zealand Argentina game was such a letdown. But yeah, so I think the Northern Hemisphere is catching up. I do. I think it's mostly because the Kiwis have been exporting coaches for so long that like we know all of their tricks now. And you know, it's harder and harder to invent new stuff that breaks rugby open the way the New Zealanders used to do. And South Africa have been so clever with the way that they bring the right type of player through, and the way that they've created a completely different game plan, a completely different outlook on it from everybody else. But I think Ireland are starting to do something similar. Like Ireland play in a way that nobody else in the world plays. I think it's difficult to maintain in knockout rugby because continuity is such a big part of it. You're going to get injuries and stuff like that. But you know, they believe in what they're doing. They're sticking to it. And I thought France had sort of a similar thing, but I think it turns out they just have DuPont. But we'll see if they can turn it around in the rest of the Six Nations. But I'm really excited for their World Cup in 4 years' time. And I think for me, if there's one thing that the Northern Hemisphere can learn from the Southern Hemisphere, I think it's don't take, if you're a team that really has World Cup ambitions, you can't take the Six Nations super seriously for 4 years. Like you have to blood new players, you have to try new guys out, you have to put yourselves in situations that you may find yourself in come a World Cup. And I hope Ireland will do that. You know, there's not many places in that squad where they don't have depth now. I think what happens against Wales is going to be really interesting because Keenan might be out and he's unbelievable at 15. He's our best option there by a mile, but we don't have a number two. We need to find someone who can back him up if he gets injured at the tournament. So sorry, I've gone on for ages, but what I'm trying to say is I think the gap's closing, but I'd love to see Northern Hemisphere teams take that 4 year cycle view rather than just sacrificing that for short termism and trying to do as well as they can in the Six Nations by picking tried and tested players.
I think interestingly, a lot of the team, the Northern Hemisphere teams who have done that are probably the guys who have been coached by Southern Hemisphere people. I mean, Eddie Jones has been very good at that, I thought, for England. Warren Gatland for Wales in particular, the way he always steps up at a World Cup. You look back at 4 years ago or 5 years ago now to 2019, and he, I think, if he managed to beat that South African side, I think there was every chance they go on to win the World Cup.
Oh yeah. And they weren't far off. They really weren't far off. And I mean this like at the last World Cup, if I was one of the senior Welsh players who retired after the tournament, I don't know how they're ever going to get over that World Cup because they had that game completely sewn up against Argentina. Completely sewn up. I don't know how they ended up losing it. And the type of team they are, the further they go in the tournament, you just think, God, maybe like finally, maybe they're going to do it. But talk about like a nation that punches above its weight. It's amazing how good they are.
Absolutely, yeah. Now is the guess the test for Wales. Can they do it over the next 4 years? It's another massive rebuild, which actually Warren Gatland is very good at. So there's an opportunity there. And I think they've performed a lot better than people maybe would have thought of. You know, really, really tight game against England, were yet again 10 minutes away, a kick away from managing it. And
Yeah.
that's something they can learn over the next 4 years, I guess. Do you think that they have an opportunity with so many young guys coming through that they might in 4 years' time have a really good opportunity, or is it almost more an 8 year plan they've probably got now?
No, I think like first of all, like timelines in rugby are insane to me because you say 4 years and it feels like a long time. That's like 40 matches. It's really not that long, but yeah, I think in 4 years' time they'll be a threat. They've got enough good young players. They've got plenty of games to play in between now and then. I guess the thing that's always characterized the really good Welsh teams is that they have two or three superstars, and then everyone else kind of knows their job. One of the hallmarks of a Gatland team is that like your job isn't very complicated. You know, it's very simple, the stuff that he has to communicate to the players, and all that he asks is, you know, 1,000% commitment that you're as fit as they come. They always look so fit coming into tournament rugby, one of the fittest teams out there. They must push themselves through pretty crazy sessions in advance of a tournament. So yeah, I think in 4 years' time they'll be great. The question is, you know, Lloyd and Costello look like the options at 10 going into that next 4 years. Is one of them going to like grab the jersey, make it their own? Because the way that they've played historically, they've always hung their hat on like a really talented 10. Like I know a lot of people didn't like Dan Biggar, but he was a serious player, particularly for Wales. He seemed to really turn it on. So the big question mark for me would be, can they find that guy to direct the game? Because, you know, when you look at the options they have in the back row, or they've got some great wingers, really good young players like Winnett coming through. If I was a Welsh fan, I'd be really cautiously optimistic about the next World Cup. But there'll definitely be some hurt between now and then.
Definitely. Yeah. My prediction for the Six Nations is that Italy will beat Wales, but Wales will finish above them in the group stages just by bonus points, just by somehow managing it. And Italy won't win anything. They'll finish on 4 or 5 points. And Wales will somehow clinch it with a few tight games and a few poor try bonus points. So,
God, could you imagine?
That would be the most Italian thing, I feel like.
It would be. But I think looking at the way both teams are approaching it this season, I think it'll be like when they played last year. I think the Italians will have a lot of chances. I think they'll leave a few out there, and at the end of the game, they'll be like, how did we not win? But I just don't see Wales folding. I think the Italians will break before they do.
I guess, yeah, we'll have to wait and find out.
I mean, I thought France were going to win opening night too. So, you know.
Predictions go out the window, I feel like. When.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of, you're most well known for your TikTok content. Started about a year ago now, was it? Or just before the World Cup?
No, just before the World Cup. World Cup, yeah.
What got you into TikTok and sort of putting videos out there about the World Cup?
I was unemployed. That was the main reason. I was job hunting. So I work in tech in kind of creative marketing. And last year, the market wasn't very good. I was job hunting and I was like, I need something to keep myself busy. I knew I was going to be watching every game of the World Cup anyway. So I thought, all right, well, like, have a go. I'd always sort of thought I might like to do something like that, you know, creating a little video, putting it out there and getting like real-time feedback seems like a really interesting thing to do. So I had a go. I didn't think anybody would watch them. And yeah, it was mad what happened in the World Cup. Like, I couldn't believe it. You know, I had videos getting like a 250,000 views and stuff. It was wild. I never, ever thought that would happen. I still can't believe people listen to them, to be honest with you. But it's been super fun. You know, you get to meet, like, so many people message you. You kind of you end up having, like, rugby TikTok friends. Like, there are people that, after every round of games, we always have little chats and share match reports and stuff. And, yeah, it's been a trip. I didn't know what I was going to do after the World Cup because I got a job. And I have way less time now. Because, you know, I was making, like, during the World Cup, I was making 3 or 4 videos a day. But because I didn't have much else to do, I could make that work. Like, it's weird for a little 90-second video how much time and effort you have to put in behind the scenes before you put it up there, if it's going to be good, you know, if it's going to be well researched, if you're going to focus on the right things. You've got to spend ages poring over the stats from games and the stuff on the World Cup website and the Six Nations website to try and make sure that what you're saying holds water. It's been really rewarding, but it's quite a difficult thing to make work and to do consistently. But it is amazing. Like, sometimes at games, you might run into people who watch the channel, and it obviously, it makes people happy. Like, people are really happy to meet you. So it's strange. I honestly thought I'd start making videos. I'd finish the end of the World Cup. Nobody really watch it. And then I get on with my life and I do something else. But yeah, it feels like I'm stuck in it now.
I have to keep going. Yeah. The 40,000 yeah. people, the 40,000 subscribers obviously want it to keep going. One of the biggest challenges often, and one of the biggest criticisms for a lot of pundits generally, and often TikTokers, is the sort of clickbait kind of style where you have to be super positive and super negative. How do you find sort of balancing that without sort of trying to keep obviously the channel growing and get viewers, but also not just saying something for the sake of saying something?
Yeah. The thing is, I think people are even on TikTok, people are crying out for content that doesn't do that. Like, the stuff where people do that is always going to perform really, really well because it's polarizing. You know, if you upset half the people and you make half the people really happy, it's twice the engagement. That is always going to work. But, you know, when I do get comments and messages, so many of them are from people saying it's just really nice to hear someone talking about rugby, like, without a clear agenda. And I will say, though, it's easy to upset people. Like, during the World Cup, I think I made one video where I sort of mentioned that I wanted to see France beat New Zealand in the groups because I wanted to see a Northern Hemisphere World Cup win, you know? And I had loads of New Zealand fans in the comment being like, the truth comes out. We all knew you were against us. And it's like, that's not what I meant. I was, you know, you do upset people, even if you're trying to go straight down the middle. But my view is, like, I look at, because there are a couple of other rugby creators that I look at as like an example. I think they do it really well. Like Egg Chasers on YouTube, like that guy's amazing. Squidge, obviously. And neither of them hide the fact that they're, you know, Squidge is a massive Wales fan, and the Egg Chaser, what's his name? I think Tim, is a huge England fan. And they don't hide that, but it doesn't mean that they're disparaging about other nations. It doesn't mean that they're talking smack all the time. Like they still take an interest in the other team. So I think people appreciate that. So yeah, I always try and make sure that, and you know what it is? I love rugby. Like one of the reasons I did the channel is I would be saying all of this stuff to my missus or my parents or whoever would listen anyway. So, you know, I'm always going to spend time looking at other teams, trying to figure out, trying to figure out where the trends are going in the game, which coaches are doing the most interesting stuff. Because I think, like any true Norse, you know, I was never any good when I played. So you have to find another way to engage with the game.
Definitely. And then final questions or final point. I want some predictions then for the Six Nations. You've obviously said you thought that France would win that first game. Do you think that Ireland are just going to run away with it now, or has anyone got an opportunity to claw it back in?
I think it's tricky. I think the odds are now the odds are probably Ireland going to do the slam, right? Like the banana skin that they've got left is England away. Historically, that's a really, really difficult game. Looking at the way they're playing now, I think you'd be a very pessimistic Ireland fan if you said you didn't think you could go over there and win. But I do think England will, like, they'll limit their game against Ireland. I don't think they'll try and play anything super exciting. I just don't see them having made enough progress on that rush defense by the time Ireland come that they're not going to leave some holes. Because, you know, there are moments where that defense looks awesome and you can see what they're driving at, and then there are moments where it's like Swiss cheese and people are just running through. Like the two tries they conceded against Italy were criminal. Like at that level, you should not be conceding scores like that. And I just think that means that just the fact that they're bedding that in means that Ireland probably, you have to think, are going to have the edge in that game. But you know, England have to come back at some point. Like, they are a huge rugby nation. They've got really talented players. They've maybe got a coach who's a bit backwards by the kind of general top level standard at the moment. But I don't know. There's something about that game that makes me a bit worried. And yeah, and then my views at the start of the tournament, like I thought England were going to have a better tournament than they are having. I thought so much feel good factor. I thought they'd shake the chains off a little bit because it's the second year with a new coach. But, you know, we've seen none of that so far. So I think I fancied them to go up and beat Scotland at the start of the tournament. I'm not so sure about that now. Again, I just think about Finn Russell and the holes in that England defence. I know that, well, they'll have Tuilagi back, so maybe it'll be a bit better. But yeah, after the first weekend, getting Ireland France so wrong, and getting England's the kind of tournament England were going to have so wrong, I have no faith in myself to predict anything anymore.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, for coming to the podcast. It's been great hearing all of your insight and having a chat with about the future of rugby.
Mate, well, thanks for having me on. It's been really fun.
Thank you all so much for listening, and make sure you head over and follow us on social media. It's pitchside_podcast on Instagram and TobyReynolds10_ on TikTok and Twitter. Make sure you also head over to the Sports Gazette website to read articles from all of our pundits and writers here at the Sports Gazette. Make sure you like the podcast and give it a rating. It really does help. And make sure to join us next time on Pitchside with Toby Reynolds.